listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Our Earth has been changing so fast in recent years that few of us are still deeply connected to our roots, to our culture, our traditions, and to the people in our families. My guest today on Full Power Living has written a memoir about her own life, and through her writing, she shares the challenges of her own life, but also showcases community and the fabric of her homeland, India. My guest today is Uma Girish, author of Losing Amma, Finding Home. Welcome to Full Power Living, where we're helping the world to know, understand, and master the power and importance of human emotions. You can listen on blogtalkradio.com/FPL, or you're joining us today on the emotionalpro.com radio page for our live show. And you also are invited to register with iTunes to get a feed for the show. And we have a toll-free call-in number, which is 888-498-0570. And for those of you who are calling in or working with Block Talk Radio, you can also use the number that's at the top of the page. Well, Uma Girish is a mother, a daughter, a storyteller, and a survivor of loss. She's also a guide. For example, she works as a grief guide and also facilitates a life story group for seniors. She teaches about death and the need to live life meaningfully by transforming pain into purpose, which is part of what she's written about in her book, Losing Amma, Finding Home. You can find her on the web at umagirish.com. That's umagirish.com. So, Uma Girish, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you, Eileen. I'm so grateful for this opportunity to share my story with you and your listeners.
Yes. Well, let me say, having read the book cover to cover, that what an engaging writer you are. For those of you who are listening, if you want to have an engaging story that keeps you interested all the way through and has lots and lots to offer, it's a wonderful book, Losing Amma, Finding Home. Well, one of the things the powerful things that you talk about in your book is that you yourself have always been about story. And in Losing Amma, Finding Home, you share part of the story of your life, and most especially the story of the death of your mother. And I wanted to know how it is that you decided to write about death.
That's a great question, Eileen. I think the books and words that come through me are given to me. I believe that the experiences that I live through are meant for me to share so that what is singular can become universal. Because it's not just my story. Grief and loss are regular themes in everyone's life, daily life, in fact. And so yes. I share my story. My readers have the opportunity to connect the dots in their own lives. And the way that I know how to do it is through telling a story. And so picking up a pen and putting pen to paper and telling that story in the best way that I knew how to, of course, always opening myself to be a sacred container for the divine to flow through in the way I presented the message, to me seemed to be the most powerful way I could process the grief and also send my words out into the world as a way to heal the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. So, you know, when I read that, you talked about you were always interested in story. It reminded me that when I was in the fourth grade, maybe around 10 years old, I had a wonderful teacher who brought out every child's talent. And she gave me a half hour after lunch every day for half the year to stand up in front of the class and ask them what they wanted to hear a story about. And I would make up the story and illustrate it on the chalkboard. So I thought, well, that's something I have in common with you, because I like story, too.
That's a delightful teacher.
Oh, she was wonderful. I've never forgotten her. She did that for everybody. It wasn't just me. You know, whatever your talent was, she found it and helped you with it. her name was Mrs. White. I don't know what the rest of her name was, but Mrs. White. But, you know, to get back to your mother, her death was incredibly painful for you on many levels. And I would like you to start off here by talking with our listeners about some of the ways in which, you know, other than in addition to losing your mother, ways in which her death was particularly painful for you.
Well, my mother was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer just 10 days after we left India to come to the United States. This was in the spring of 2008. So we arrived here with 6 suitcases and hearts full of dreams, only to realize 10 days later that my mother had this diagnosis, which was shocking to all of us because I had bid goodbye to her on the way to the airport, and I had dreamed of going back to India, sharing stories of my life in a new culture, in a foreign country. And this diagnosis just came at a time when everything was different in my life. I was in the U.S. trying to figure out how to live in a new country. My daughter was 15 at the time, trying to get into high school here and figure her life out. My husband was trying to do something different at the workplace. And the pain of her diagnosis was so huge because we were so far away. As long as I lived in India, my mother and I, my parents and I lived just 10 minutes away from each other. So I would pop in and out constantly. I was there to help them with everything, medical appointments, buying groceries, taking food over when they were sick, things like that. And all of a sudden, I felt, oh my God, I'm a continent away when they need me the most. So yes. I prayed really hard to as a way to hopefully reverse her diagnosis through cosmic help. But when that didn't happen and she died just 8 months after her diagnosis, I was completely shattered. I was very close to her. I was her firstborn child. We talked on the phone all the time. We had long 45-minute conversations which my husband would laugh at. She shared stories about her life, about how her life changed when each of us was born, and my father moved from one city to another. So she was a great storyteller herself, and I learned so much from her through her storytelling and through sitting down around a table and having conversations. She encouraged us to speak. She encouraged us to feel. Feeling emotion was never disallowed in my family. We felt everything we needed to feel. It was okay to cry. We were held. We laughed together. We complained. We felt everything as a family. And so I think that knit us very close to each other. And when she was gone, I felt like my foundation went missing. She was my beginning. Uh-huh. She was my first home. And at the time when I had moved to the U.S. and I was trying to figure out, is this home, is India home? Where is home and what is home? I felt like I had lost the most primal home I had known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was really striking to me because my birth mother actually did not take good care of me and my sister, and we were awarded to my father as a single parent when I was less than 3 years old, and then my father was in the military. So for me, it was quite striking to see the vast differences, both in actual circumstances and also in emotion, when you've been able to stay in one place and one culture with one family and be nurtured the way that you describe in Losing Amma, Finding Home, versus the sort of nomadic life that I experienced growing up. And it really gave me a lot of insight to, it got me thinking about, you know, how would I feel if everything had been the same for so long and then suddenly broke apart? And your mother, too, seems like she was quite a remarkable woman, very very powerful in the lives of all the people in the family, just through her love and through her constancy.
Yeah, it's interesting you say this because the reality of concepts like blended families and broken families and children growing up with single parents became a reality to me only after we moved to the States. I didn't see any of that growing up. I only knew families where there were two parents or one because one of them had died. But I didn't know much about families that blended, where children had to live with stepchildren and stepparents. All of that was a huge revelation. And the more I heard stories about how people separated and how they divorced and how abandonment, I felt infinitely grateful for the life I had been given. Because as long as I lived in India, I guess, as we all do up to a certain age, we focus on what's missing and not what's present. But having moved to the States and seeing how vastly different a culture this is, and how many of the stories that came to me were so different from my own experience, I grew to have a new gratitude for what I had been given. Yeah, so my mother was really the central figure in our family. Although she was not powerful in the way that we define powerful, she was a very simple woman. She never argued with anybody. She didn't know how to fight back. She didn't know how to hurt anybody. She was extremely quiet, very simple and humble. But when we lost her, we realized how powerful her presence had been all along to keep the family together.
Wow. Wow. And this topic that we've opened up here is really, really wonderful aspect of your book and your writing, where you allow those of us who are reading to understand more about the culture in which you grow up, in which you grew up and in which you lived. And there were so many differences. I mean, I grew up in the 50s, the 40s and 50s, and most people had intact families then. But it's so clear that there are patterns in the Indian culture, there are traditions that have to be handled, there are ways of figuring out who's responsible for what when the parents get older, there are rituals through religion that people, a lot of people do, and so forth. It was really a wonderful way to know more about the culture in India by reading your book. I really appreciate that part.
Thank you. Yeah, I grew up with culture and rites and rituals all around me every moment of every day, it seemed. There was a ritual for every little thing. I jokingly say you had a ritual to go to the bathroom. It was that, you know, prevalent in our daily experience. So that is a part of who I am, and I had to incorporate that in the story as I wrote it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, to get back to the pain, as a host of this radio program, I read a lot of people's books, and especially in the last few years, has become evident to me that the places of intense pain that most of us get into, when we can heal those places, they become the essence of the purpose of our life. And that's part of what has happened for you, too. You moved into working in the field of loss and grief, correct?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
And you have this great quote. You say, "Buried beneath the chaos and ruins of my tragic situation are treasures that I'm slowly waking up to." What are some of the treasures that you were able to translate into your work as a grief guide?
So when we moved to the States, my plan was to come here and teach ESL, English as a second language. I used to teach business English back home in India. I worked part-time as a trainer for the British Council. And so I thought, okay, in the U.S., people don't need much tutoring in business English. The kind of work I can move into would be teaching ESL because there are many immigrants that are struggling to learn the language. However, I didn't know that this life event was going to change and shift things in a whole new way. So when my mother died, unbeknownst to me, several things shifted within me. There's one particular image that I talk about in the book, seeing her body on the floor of our living room at home, because in India, the body leaves from the home. The last rites are performed at home, and it leaves for the crematorium from the place of residence. And as my sisters and I bathed her body and performed all the rituals to get her ready, we draped her body in this beautiful silk sari, got her ready for her final journey, one recurring thought looped around my head, and that was, we come into this world with nothing, and we leave with nothing. Why then do we spend so much time struggling to accumulate and acquire and possess? Life is all about how much we have, and yet we get to take nothing of it. I don't believe it's an original thought, but it was a moment in which that particular thought had neon lights around it. And for me, that
right.
shifted everything. That told me that there was something more to this life that we were meant to pay attention to. And it was that uh-huh. urgency that moved me to ask, who am I? Why am I here? What is the meaning of this life? What am I meant to do with this life that I've been given? And those are the treasures I talk about. Those are the true treasures that we wake up to when something tragic happens in our lives. Because those are the questions that move us into the space of purpose and meaning. And if our lives don't have purpose and meaning, we don't really connect with joy. So in abandoning what I had come to do and moving into something that had opened up for me, I found unimaginable treasures. Working with seniors, for instance, I mean, how precious to be able to preserve some of their legacy in the form of stories. How precious to be able to give them a safe space in which they can share these stories and have the spotlight shined on them for those 60 minutes every week. These are people who are so lonely, who think their stories have no value, no one has the time to listen to them. I get to give them those 60 minutes in which they come alive and speak about times in their lives when they struggled, when they experienced joy, when they knew pain. And in helping others move through their own personal grief and loss, I connect with my own healing at a much deeper level. So I'm living my life intentionally. I'm living on purpose with meaning and joy. Every morning that I wake up, I know I'm here to make a difference. Every night when my head touches the pillow, I know that my being here on the planet has left something behind. And this is the question I've come to. I ask every night as I go to bed, what am I leaving behind today instead of what am I getting out of life today or what did I get out of life today? So those are the true treasures I've woken up to.
And the description you just gave of working with the seniors, you are offering them that opportunity too. I'm thinking your comments about our material lives, so many people get caught up in the material lives and then, especially in our culture, they are very alone and lonely and feel like they have nothing to hold on to anymore. And yet when you ask them or help them to tell their story, to tell what it is that has gone on in their life, they too must become aware of what they're leaving behind.
That is so true, Eileen. It's wonderful that I reconnect the dots when I look back. I didn't know it back then. But what I was experiencing when I moved to the States from India was the pain and grief of dislocation. And the very first job, the only part-time position that opened up for me was at this senior living community. And when I look back, I think to myself, who knows the pain of dislocation, the grief of dislocation better than seniors who've had to give up their neighborhoods, homes they've lived in for 40, 50 years? People they've known, they're unable to connect because they don't understand technology, so they feel cut off from family members, their great-grandchildren. Who understands that sense of dislocation? And how wonderful that the universe planted me in their midst. And through the grief and pain of that dislocation, we built bridges to each other's lives. Here I am, a woman from India who knows nothing about big band music or Dean Martin or Dancing in the Rain, none of that. And I do now because I'm mentioning those very things to you in this interview. So they taught me
right.
about their lives while I told them so many stories from my life. It was a beautiful, precious
yes.
connection.
Yes, that's really great. I want to talk about the fracture that occurs when we encounter change, when we come back from our break. My guest today is Uma Girish, who is author of Losing Amma, Finding Home. We'll find out more about the incredible ways that Uma's life has changed following the death of her mother when we return here on Full Power Living.
How would you parent your child if he or she were a foreign exchange student? As a host for an exchange student, you'd have five main jobs to do. Those are the same five jobs important in raising kids. People around the world have used this approach to raise kids who are self-directed, make great decisions, and are immune to peer pressure. Get your copy of The Exchange Student Model for Parenting, written by me, Eileen Dillon, now available on Kindle. As a 41-year marriage and family therapist, a single, married, step, adoptive, and grandmother, I've got a thing or two to tell you that's going to lighten your load as a parent and help you create incredible kids who will become amazing adults. Go to Kindle.com and download The Exchange Student Model for Parenting today.
Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. Next week on Full Power Living, we're having a reconnection with Dr. Eric Pearl, who is author of his book, The Reconnection. Dr. Pearl is a healer who discovered how to do amazing energy healings, which he's been teaching to others around the world. And since his last visit with us, he's made some changes in his approach, and that's what we'll be talking about next week here on Full Power Living. Listen next Thursday, July 30th at 9 a.m. Pacific or noon Eastern. And we also would like you to register at emotionalpro.com so that we can send you our twice-weekly newsletter that will keep you up to date on the shows and topics we're covering every month. And while you're there, click on the CCFL Global Academy logo on the landing page. Monday, I'm giving a one-hour introduction to parenting consciously to all interested members of the CCFL Global Academy. I'm the Academy's expert on emotional mastery and ending codependence, and I'm also sharing with people my five-part approach to raising incredible kids, what we were just talking about on the ad with the exchange student model. One of the vital things you'll discover is a clear definition of what the job of being a parent is all about and also what the job of being a child is. So do go over to emotionalpro.com, sign up for our newsletter, and click on the Global Academy and check it out. Today is Uma Girish, who is a mother, a daughter, a storyteller, and a survivor of loss, who now works as a grief guide and facilitates a life story group for seniors. She's the author of Losing Ama, Finding Home. So before the break, Uma, I said that I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the fracturing that goes on. I've been a psychotherapist in California for the last 43 years, and I had the good fortune of having a wonderful therapist when I was starting out for myself, who helped me through what she called the identity crisis process. And basically, it's a process, or it's a description of what happens when we have changes that break the continuity of the life we've been living, how we fall apart, we feel like we're dying on some level, we separate from others, then we go through a bit of a no man's land, and finally we begin to reconstruct our lives, this time based on what's vital and important to us, and usually set off in new directions. And in reading your book, that sounds to me a lot about what was happening for you throughout the process of the part of your life you're reporting there.
Yeah, my identity, in a sense, suffered greatly when we moved from India to the U.S. All of a sudden, I didn't have a context. Nobody knew me here. I didn't know anybody here. So there was that basic identity confusion. And then when my mother passed away, I guess this primal mother-child bond no matter how old you are, when you lose a parent, I think you still feel as a child, because especially when it's a mother, because you, like I say, her home was my first home. She was the first human being who loved me. She taught me how to love and relate to life and engage. So there was that very deep sense of loss and that yearning to belong to someone in a way that matters. You know, the mother-child bond is something so primal that that connection can never be reciprocated, almost. It feels to me sacred and divine, and I felt I had lost that. So there was a sense mm-hmm. of, who am I? I don't have a mother anymore. I'm a motherless daughter. That became my identity. Then I also had to shift out of that, because that didn't tell the whole story of who I am. So in the process of unraveling my own significance of being here on the planet at this time, trying to understand, who am I really? Am I an ego? Am I a soul? What is the meaning of a soul? Is that my true identity? I examined all the evidence that came to me through books and through all kinds of teachings, through the teachers that I worked with personally, and I had to find my way back home to myself. That's why I titled the book, Losing Amma, Finding Home. And through the confusion and the darkness and all the meandering and all the wandering, I came back home to my own self. And that I know now is my true identity. My soul is my true identity. My connection with the divine is my true identity. And that begets the question, well, if I am a soul and I'm a fragment of the divine, then my being on planet Earth at this time has to have more significance than just being a consumer, than being someone who uses the Earth's resources to live and sustain her life and the life of the people she loves. It has to be about service. It has to be about giving back and making a difference and being connected to the web of life. So from that core question of identity, who am I, so much emerged that brought me home to myself. And does that answer your question?
Yes, and it's beautiful. I'm just sitting here being fascinated listening to you. You know, I'm aware from reading, well, I surmise from reading your book. I don't know for sure if that was so, but I know you had a spiritual orientation and so forth, but even in your book you say, well, we did this ritual and I wasn't quite sure what it was all about. The priest did it, or the you know, someone else did it. And then you moved into reading Eckhart Tolle and studying things that Oprah offered and opening yourself up to this very, I don't know, spiritual as opposed to religious essence. And it seemed to me that there was a profound shift in you from knowing maybe something about religion but not being that, into the spiritual and being the spiritual. Is that accurate or not?
That's pretty accurate, Eileen. Yes, as long as I lived in India, I was born into the land of rituals and ceremony, but for most of my growing years, I didn't understand why I was doing what I was doing, why the elders around me did certain things. But questioning wasn't encouraged in our culture. My mother would say, we didn't question our elders. When they told us to do something, we simply obeyed. And that's what we were expected to do as children. But I was a 60s child, so I asked questions. And when I didn't find the answers I was seeking, I rebelled. I said, I don't want to do this if I don't understand why I'm doing it. So rituals were fairly meaningless to me for most of my life. And so when I found the truth that Eckhart Tolle was speaking about in The Power of Now and A New Earth, it woke me up to a new way of being, because for the longest time I had rebelled against a God who had sounded to me like someone who was vengeful, who punished if you stepped out of line, and who was sitting there like some kind of cosmic avenger, and that was not the God I knew to be true. Something in my eight-year-old heart knew that God was love. And so the God that was being presented to me through religion, through the elders, through the rituals we were told to do, did not resonate with me at all. And in reading books written by Wayne Dyer and Eckhart Tolle and many others, I suddenly woke up to this realization that, yes, this is the God I have been seeking all my life. This is the truth. This is what is real. I am a soul. I am not someone who is here to walk according to other people's directions and instructions. My soul knows why I'm here. All the wisdom that I need is within me. And that wisdom was being tapped into. With everything I read and everything I heard, that wisdom was being reawakened. And that's how I came home to myself. And that was the shift from meaningless traditional rituals to meaningful, you know, soul conversations. And I do rituals now because I create them. I create rituals that are powerful for me and meaningful for me. They don't have to look like anybody else's rituals, but they are mine and they have significance. And when I do them with that sense of reverence and awe, they transform and they transmute. So I think I'm finally connecting the dots. I'm finally able to understand why we did what we did. I'm slowly beginning to peel back the layers in a way that I didn't know then.
Wow, that's really beautiful that you were able to do that. And that was not an easy transition. Let me go back to that, because your daughter was going off to college and your husband was working really hard. He was very involved in supporting the family, and he was expecting you to step up and also help with the financial support. And as part of this fragmenting, as part of opening to this new way, you... And this happens all the time in this process, which I help people through as a therapist. You couldn't take any action. You didn't know which way to go. You essentially sat on your hands for a period of time, and that was not an easy thing to do under the circumstances.
No, it was not. It was the hardest time of my life because my soul was screaming from within, and I didn't know how to explain this to anybody in my life, least of all my husband. But the calling was so powerful and so urgent. All I knew was that I had to serve. I had to serve. And I don't know where this call came from, but it was a voice I was simply unable to ignore. And so in that time of not being able to communicate my intention to my husband, I, like you said, sat on my hands. I had to stay quiet because any conversation would just erupt into an argument where I wouldn't understand his language and he clearly couldn't understand mine. So those 2 years that I devoted to serving people, I went to retirement homes and nursing homes, and I spent time with the elderly, just being with them, being a presence in their lives, listening to their stories, comforting the lonely, giving them a massage. I would sit by the bedside of comatose patients and read them prayers. This is all I did day in and day out for 2 years. I call this period the apprenticeship of my soul. It was something I could not ignore. It was the only way I knew how to be. And every night I went to bed living a life of service, I was able to sleep peacefully. But there was this conflict within me. How do I explain this to people in my life? How do I explain that I'm unable to commit to making money just because we need to sustain ourselves? Because that voice also told me, you will be taken care of. You will be taken care of. And I couldn't figure out how. I wasn't supposed to. I wasn't expected to. I just had to trust. It was a walk in faith and trust. I mean, it was the hardest time of my life. It was a difficult time in our marriage. But the fact that we're still holding hands today tells me that our commitment and our love for each other transcended that difficult period.
So that seems to me to bring up a really important point for people who are listening, who may be in a crisis of faith themselves, in the sense of feeling something strongly, being drawn to something strongly inside of themselves, yet not having a full logical explanation for it. And being able to give themselves permission to go ahead and follow what's coming up inside of them. How did you do that? Could you just not, you felt compelled, or did you have to really work with yourself to help yourself stay on that path?
It was actually easy for me to stay on the path because it was very compelling. It was a voice I couldn't ignore. What was harder was, how do I put this into words and translate this into, this is how I need to be living my life now. I don't know how to explain it to you. So the drama, the balance between the commercial life and the life of meaning and essence, there was a constant tug of war between the two. And there were many hours I would sit down and just cry. I would just cry to God and say, you know, why am I here? What am I meant to do? What are you asking of me? Where is this leading to? And I knew that I had to live in the questions. We tried too hard to get to the answers. But that's the great mystery of life, right? We don't know the answers until we are willing to live in the questions. God only says, get out of bed today and do as I tell you to do. Put one foot in front of the other. Obey the instructions for today. Forget about tomorrow. That's not here yet. And that's the hardest thing to do. Oh, yesterday. That's right. So that for me was the hardest thing to do because I had never lived my life like that. I had always planned, anticipated, you know, secured my future, knew what was coming up 3 months from now, the classes I had to teach, the articles I had to write, the book I was working on, everything was planned. So this was being dropped into a space, a vacuum, where the universe said, now get comfortable with not knowing. And to me, that was truly the way to the light. Because I was willing to live there and say, okay, I can't obey two masters, God and money. I have to choose one. And so, okay, I choose God because money isn't working for me right now. It's something that I'm unable to ignore. I have to do this. And truly, that is what saved my life. That is what healed my grief. Service is what healed my grief ultimately. And that's something I speak about with every client who works with me today. My youngest client is 24. My oldest is 92. But I constantly speak about the theme of service in our lives.
Right. Well, as a therapist, I learned years ago that people who are really depressed, one of the best ways to get out of depression is to do what is known as selfless service, which is what you were doing. You were doing the service without thinking what you were going to get back from it, just doing the service. So, and I wanted to comment too, Uma. One of my children, my youngest, is working in the jungles of Amazon. She's turning 28 next week. She works with a maternal health project. She's been there for 6 years. She runs the American side. It's a indigenous American project, a co-project. And through her, I've become aware of an incredible network of young people who come out of college and go right into service, working in projects like this. Some are setting up solar installations. Some are helping with composting toilets. Some are helping with maternal health projects like she is. And so it kind of brings to my mind that not only did you need to serve, but in actual fact, the way the earth is moving, service is what we all are moving toward. What are your comments on that?
I completely agree with you. I think there's a huge shift, a universal movement, where more and more people are waking up to what is the meaning of life. And I think more and more people are finding the answer to that being, make a difference. What you've been given is not meant to be in service just to yourself and the people you love, but this is in service to a cause that's much bigger than what you even know or understand. And it's wonderful that people in their 20s are waking up to that urgency because they are the ones who are inheriting the earth. And if they can wake up to that and, you know, put their hands up and say, I'm going to be part of this movement. I'm going to make it matter. I'm going to make my life purposeful and meaningful and leave something behind for my children, my grandchildren, the generations to come. I mean, how wonderful is that? So I believe,
yes,
like you said earlier, that selfless service is really the way to healing everything in one's life, I would say. I mean, because your life is all about the life of everyone you serve. That's what I say. That's the truth I found for myself, and I know it to be true for many people who have managed to pull out of depression, pull out of apathy and indifference when they connect with something bigger than themselves. The moment we step out of this bubble of, you know, self-indulgence, that's when life begins to make sense. That's when you begin to see your place in the world as meaningful and purposeful. And I do believe selfless service is the way to the light.
Wow, that's so wonderful. It's lovely to hear you you say that. You know, there were some other shifts that I observed in you that I'd like to talk about. One is about guilt. Many times, now here you were living in the U.S., not only did your mother die within the year, the first year that you came to the U.S., but not too long after that, your father also passed away. And I know that your grandmother passed away this week, so I just want to express my condolences to you. It must be really hard to be so far away when that happens. So you were going through a lot of grief, but also you had a lot of opportunity to feel guilty because I'm not here, I'm not there. Now, my learning as a therapist is that guilt is a form of anger, and it comes when we are caught on the horns of a dilemma, that if you stayed here in your new life, things would not work out. You'd miss things that were important to you. But if you went to India, you would miss out, say, on your daughter's development here in the United States. So the bottom line is we feel guilty when we're caught between two things and we lose no matter what we do. Interesting to me is as you kept writing the book, you, to my observation, talked less and less about guilt, which I found fascinating. Do you have any comments on this?
Yeah, first of all, I want to thank you for acknowledging my grandmother's passing. Yes, it happened on the 20th of July, and I'm still living with that. But to answer your question about guilt, yes, there's never one way to do it right. If I was going to be here, I was going to miss out on my parents. And how to serve them, and if I was going to be in India, I was going to miss all the new beginnings in my daughter's life and shepherd her through some of that, those early times of stepping into a high school and moving into a new culture of learning. But as time went on and as I plunged deeper into this work of learning and a new way of being, I realized that when someone dies, when a loved one dies, we believe the relationship ends. And it does end on the physical plane, but the love never ends. The relationship is ongoing, it's just in a different form. It takes a different energy. And I knew then that I could speak to my mother and tell her what I was guilty about, apologize for not being there during those 8 months when she needed me to be there for her. And so I could make things right through letter writing, through ritual, through connecting with her in meditation. I found new tools that I could use. Being guilty felt powerless. I couldn't do anything. Just being guilty was just negative emotion. It just made me feel worse. It wasn't resolving anything. And so I used all the new spiritual tools that I was finding to make peace with it. And I also knew on a deep soul level, and this was the new learning that moved me to that place, that she and I as souls had created this contract that I would move to the States, she would get cancer, she would die 8 months later, and through her passing and this profound transformation that was birthed in me, I would go on to live the next chapter of my life. So when I looked at it from that point of view, it all seemed perfect. There was no need for guilt. There was no need for anger, none of that. I could let it all go. I am serving so many people today in a way that I could never have done if I had been in India with my mother through those 8 months. I don't know how life might have changed for me had I been in India, but having been planted in the U.S., I knew that I had to bloom here.
Yes, that's really, I think when you expand to that larger level, that's one of the really comforting things is things start falling together. Oh, well, this may have seemed like a horrible tragedy at the time it was occurring, but look at the enormous amount of larger good that came out of it. And it encourages you then to, when something starts, as your life goes on and when things come up, you just go, well, this has some pain to it, but let's see where it's going to take us, you know, because you're anticipating that larger thing. So thank you for pointing that out. We're up to our second break right now. I'm talking with Uma Girish, who is the author of Losing Ama, Finding Home. We'll be right back.
Eileen Dillon is a certified senior life mentor with Accessing Universal Intelligence. She's available to conduct mentoring sessions with you to help you understand, change, and evolve using the advice of your own higher self. You can be anywhere in the world. Sessions are conducted through Skype. For more information about these life mentoring sessions, fees, and how to register, go to www.emotionalpro.com and click on the mentoring link at the top. Get personally tailored assistance with your toughest life questions. Visit mentoring@emotionalpro.com today.
Losing Ama, Finding Home is her book. Uma Girish is the author, sharing the personal transformation that came from death and loss in her life. So before we get back into questions, Uma, where can people find your book? Where can they buy it? I know your website is umagirish.com, but where can they find your book?
Folks can find my book on Amazon as well as on my website, umagirish.com. If you buy it through my website, I have the delightful opportunity of autographing it personally. I write a little message for every book that I send out, but you're more than welcome to buy a Kindle version. There's paperback also available on Amazon. So that's the best way to find my book.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Now, so much, you've written so much about death, and one of the things that I loved about reading your book was some of your turns of phrase. The way you say things has a tendency to just come straight into a person's heart. And so I've written down a few of the quotes regarding death. I know you've become a grief counselor, a grief guide, and so I'm going to talk a little bit about grief and death and then ask you to blend that in with telling us what exactly a grief guide does. Some of the quotes are, you can't have a dress rehearsal for death. Grief feels like utter abandonment. Grief is its own orchestra. How do you tie those together with being a grief guide, will you?
So the reason why I call myself a grief guide as opposed to a grief counselor is because I see my role in the life of someone grieving a loss as a guide, as a Sherpa who climbs mountains with people. I hold their hand and walk with them on what could be a long and painful journey. And everyone's journey is very different. I don't see myself as a teacher. What I do is I ask you good questions as a way to help you find your way back home to your own wisdom, because I believe that we all have our wisdom within ourselves. And my answers can't be true for you. Your answers can't be true for someone else. My soul knows my journey. Your soul knows your journey. So all I do is I act as a facilitator in your life. I hold your hand and I guide you with as much compassion and kindness as I can to find you, to help you find your way back home to your true self.
That's so wonderful. I've had the opportunity to participate in the death of a few people. My first husband's grandmother, when she died at the age of 94. My older sister died 10 years ago from ovarian cancer and came to be with us in the last 7 years of her life. And my husband's ex-wife also passed away with pancreatic cancer. So I've been around, and one of the things that I didn't know before I did that, a gift it was to me to be with these people as they were making their transition to wherever the next place is. And I hear that in your voice too, that you're being a Sherpa, but you're also getting to go up the mountain, you know, you're getting something too.
Oh, absolutely. I feel it is sacred. The time of death is a sacred time. Just like we celebrate the birth of a baby, there's so much joy and hope and new vistas of possibility that open up when there's a childbirth. We don't look at death as celebration, but helping mm-hmm. someone transition through that sacred time, to me, feels really precious to be able to bear witness to that sacred moment in someone's life. It's a reaffirmation that they're going back home, they're going back to where they came from, and to be a midwife at that time to me seems as sacred as being a midwife when a child is being born. So I find that peace, it's a reminder of my own mortality, it's a reminder that I need to be purposeful in everything I do in the time that I've been given.
Yes. Wow, that's really great. And just to sum that up, I read a quote from your book. I know now that death is neither a beginning nor an end, that life is simply the beginning of a new form, that the act of dying is walking through the door to another life. I really like that. I like the way you turn phrases. Since we also talk about emotions on this show, which, of course, certainly there are plenty of emotions when we're talking about dying and grief, you have a quote about fear that I like. Fear is a monster you can lock away in a closet, but you can never throw the key away. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think the biggest fear that we have is of fear itself. We fear fear. And as long as we are unwilling to look at that fear in the face and ask, why are you here? What are you here to teach me? What am I truly afraid of? Fear will be the monster in that closet. So we can pretend the monster doesn't exist. We can ignore it. We can push it away when it tries to surface, when it's banging on the closet door for attention. We can do all of that. But we know at some deep level that the key is with us. And we eventually have to open that closet, unlock it, and stare that monster in the face. Only then does it cease to be. Because fear dissolves when you look at it. The longer you don't look at it, the longer you're pushing it away, the greater it grows in magnitude and intensity. And that's how it is for me too, with every fearful experience, everything that I anticipate will go wrong, if I have fear attached to it. If I have a public speaking event that I'm afraid will go wrong, people won't show up, or I'm going to stumble and stutter, I have to sit down and say, what am I really afraid of? What is this bringing up within me that I need to shine a spotlight on, that I need to attend to? And when I do that, the fear dissolves almost magically. So that's what I mean. We have the key. We just pretend we don't know where the key is. We've lost it. We don't remember where it is, but we do have a key, and we need to unlock that closet door and face that monster.
Yes, that's really great. Years ago, as I was working on my own fear, I came up with a saying that when you operate on the motive of fear, you're guaranteed to create that which you fear. I realized when you hold it inside, then you just quake and fear, here it comes. It doesn't disappear
That's
at all.
Right. Yeah, and the easiest thing to do is ask the question, am I acting from a place of fear or am I acting from a place of love? And if I choose to move from fear to love, what would love do in this situation? What would love do?
Mm-hmm. Wow. You have another quote. You just were talking with us about being a grief guide. You left India, where you could have taken care of the elderly people in your family, and you came to the United States and took care of the elderly people in the U.S. And one of the comments you make, and I quote, is, "It's not blood that connects you to a human being. It's the bridge you build, one heart to another." I know you've talked about that some already this morning, but do you have anything to add?
Well, this is how I look at it. I look at all of us as being interconnected on this human journey. And that's not how we always look at other people. We live in the space of separation because there's always the ego that comes in and plays these little mind games that says, I'm better than someone, I know how to do this better. What she thinks is not right, my point of view is the right point of view to have. And when we separate, we divide. So when we build a bridge to another's heart, we connect to the essence of their humanity. I like to say we all cry the same tears. We all laugh the same. We all feel the same. And when we can connect to that place, and that connection happens when someone is in pain or grief. So that was the most intimate connection I was able to make with these seniors. And when I was able to do that, my culture didn't matter, my nationality didn't matter, the color of my skin didn't matter. It was one heart connecting with another.
That's so beautiful. Well, I actually wrote on the chat that I feel like I could listen to you for hours. Not only do you have wonderful things to say, but I love the sound of your voice and the cadence of your accent as well. So,
thank you, Eileen.
But I have to end. So, you know, thank you for writing such a compelling book and for addressing the universal issues such as who we know ourselves to be and how we live our lives and how to turn loose of people and places that may feel like they're part of the fabric of our being. So let me remind people that the name of your book is Losing Amma, Finding Home. And thank you so much for being with us here today on Full Power Living, Uma. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Eileen. Thank you so much. This was such a delightful conversation, and I'm deeply, deeply honored for your invitation to be here.
Great. So next week, listen to Full Power Living when I talk with Dr. Eric Pearl about new advances in his healing methodology, Reconnection. I also look forward to having you with us every Thursday, including next Thursday, July 23rd at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern. Mike Cantor, who's affiliated with Fresh Talk Media, has been our producer today. Thank you very much, Mike. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
To Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.